Bodger, one of many writer author members of the library. And 8 years ago, I left my downtown life and moved reluctantly to the Upper East Side. I was miserable until I met this library. Now I have to live within walking distance because the library has become an indispensable part of my writing and reading life, as it is for so many members. Moving uptown also brought me closer to my friend, novelist Marnie Mueller. It was Marnie who introduced me to her friend, Susan Quinn. Sue's new book, Eleanor and Hick, seemed to me a perfect fit for a library event. Before I tell you a little about Susan Quinn, please take a moment to turn off all devices that might make noise and interrupt our evening together. Yes? And let me remind you also that at a table right outside this room in the Peluso Family Gallery, our colleagues from the Corner Bookstore have Susan Quinn's book available for sale. And of course, the author will be glad to sign your copies after her presentation. Susan Quinn was a very accomplished journalist before she became a very accomplished biographer. She has written for The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, and The Boston Globe Magazine, among many other publications. She lives outside Boston, and she's a former chair of Penn New England. Her first book, A Mind of Her Own, The Life of Karen Horney, not only won the Boston Globe's Winship Award, but led to both a Guggenheim Fellowship and a Rockefeller Foundation residency in Bellagio, which in turn led to the research for Ms. Quinn's much-acclaimed biography titled Marie Curie, A Life, a book that has been showered with honors and translated into 9 languages. Clearly, strong, forward-thinking women are her métier, which is demonstrated again in Eleanor and Hick, love affair that shaped her first lady. To anyone interested in modern American political history, Roosevelts are never very far from mind. And Eleanor and Hick is a stunning addition to our understanding of Eleanor Roosevelt's public and private life. The book has already gotten wonderful reviews from the New York Review of Books, The New Yorker, The Economist, and Library Journal, and it received a coveted starred Kirkus Review. We are lucky and excited to have Susan Quinn here with us tonight. So please welcome her to the library.
Thank you so much, Laurie. Thank you to my fellow writer, Marnie Mueller, with whom I've talked about a lot about making this happen along the way. I'm honored to be speaking to you in this wonderful library, which has been a destination and a resource for so many great American writers. I was especially moved to learn that Willa Cather was a member of the New York Society Library. My mother loved Willa Cather, and so do I. Willa Cather was also one of Lorena Hickok's favorite writers, partly because she wrote so vividly about the Dakota Plains, where Lorena Hickok grew up, and partly because she shared Hick's passion for opera divas. Also, Cather lived for many years with her companion, Edith Lewis, in Greenwich Village, the place Eleanor Roosevelt found as her spiritual home among her closest friends, women living in life partnerships with other women. So Willa Cather's life and work hovering around me as I wrote this book. And maybe she's hovering tonight. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the process, the torturous ups and downs that resulted finally in this book. And then I'll read a short passage. And of course, I'll welcome questions afterward. Every book has its ups and downs, as many of you know. This was no exception. Began really 8 years ago after I finished a book called Furious Improvisation, which was a book about the Federal Theater Project, which was one of the Roosevelt WPA projects. And
I really liked living in the New Deal era, and I wanted to write about it again. So I got the idea of doing a biography of Harry Hopkins, and I spent a whole year on that. I have an agent who kind of figures importantly in my story named Jill Neerham, and Jill is very big on writing very ambitious proposals, needing a lot of time for proposal. So I spent a whole year doing preliminary research, doing a proposal, photographs, everything. Thought it looked great, she thought it looked great, but we couldn't sell it. And I think the reason was that really, I wasn't really in it. I thought it was an important book to write, but it wasn't the book I cared about writing. So, you know, they say write what you know, but I think more importantly, write what you care about. And somehow, I didn't care enough about this, and I couldn't find a way to shape it. So that got me really depressed, and I thought my writing life was over. I really didn't think I'd find another subject ever. And then I'm not sure how it came together, but I realized that there was a story connected to Harry Hopkins that was both more compact and more compelling. It had to do with a woman named Lorena Hickok, who had had a relationship with Eleanor Roosevelt. I knew a little bit of background. I knew that there were letters, and there was even a book written back in 1980 by a woman named Doris Faber. Well, it turns out that Lorena Hickok and Eleanor Roosevelt exchanged over 3,000 letters, most of which Lorena Hickok gave to the FDR Library in Hyde Park when she died in 1968. But she gave them both sides of the correspondence with the stipulation that they couldn't be open for 10 years. So, in 1978, a woman named Doris Faber happened to be at the library. She was somebody who had written a number of books about presidential wives. And she was the first one to see the letters. And she was horrified by the letters. She even tried to get the library to lock the letters up, and she wrote at the time, "Could any thinking person not realize that these are love letters?" And she felt that it was going to embarrass Eleanor Roosevelt, and they simply shouldn't be written about at all. Finally, she decided that in order to keep other people from writing something salacious, she would write the book about the letters. So she did that. And this is a book mostly about Lorena Hickok being in love with Eleanor Roosevelt and not the other way around. And when the book came out, there was a lesbian publication called Big Mama Rag, and they lamented that turning over those letters to Doris Faber was a crime akin to turning over Sappho's poems to medieval Christian theologians. So I realized right away this was an opportunity to revisit the story and change times. Can everyone hear me well?
Yeah.
Here's where writing about what you can connect with came into it. So all my books, with one exception, have been about strong, remarkable women. Karen Horney, as Laurie mentioned, and then Marie Curie, and even the theater book focused on Hallie Flanagan, who was the head of WPA, just an amazing woman. Also, point two, even though the love relationship had been floating around in the atmosphere, times had changed a lot, as we all know. And this was a story that could be embraced, it could even be celebrated, about two women who loved and empowered each other. It also helped that I have a daughter, Anna, who's queer, has a partner and a wonderful four-year-old. Because of Anna, I have a more accepting and tender feeling about the subject of love between women. So there it was. I knew it from the moment it came to me. I remember where I was even when I knew it. This was the book I should be writing. So I set out to write another proposal, another 50-page proposal, which took months and months. April 2012, I went out to 20 publishers. The response was not all positive. An editor at one large house said, "It feels like a slice of the Eleanor market, unclear how big." And another one said, "I'm not sure we can garner significant attention beyond the lovely reviews it will no doubt receive." But there were positive ones too. One said it's an amazing thing to read a strong proposal and know without any doubt how much more exceptional the book itself will be. So that was very positive, but it also turned out to be problematic.
July 2012, I had a contract by that time with Penguin Press after a bidding war. 2.5 years later, the book was done, and I was very, very pleased with it. I had a date with my agent on December 8, 2014. I have it in my calendar. It says lunch with 3 exclamation points. I thought it was going to be a triumphal lunch, and I thought she would pay for it. She hadn't been paying for my lunches for a while. Now she'll pay for it. But she did pay for lunch. But the lunch didn't turn out the way I expected. I thought I was done. But according to Jill, I really wasn't. She thought the writing of this draft was stiff and distancing. There were just way too many quotes. She said, every time their quotation marks, I feel like I'm being pushed away from the material. And what's with this calling her ER? I was calling her ER because this is a convention that's been used by other biographers of Eleanor Roosevelt. There's FDR, there's TR, and there's ER. But her feeling was it was cold. And that was the key. She said, well, what's very, it's inhibited. She said, what happened? And she said, it has nothing like the life that the proposal had. So I was devastated. And it happened to be a snowy day, so I walked home in the snowstorm with the tears coming down my face along with the snow. I was angry, I was upset, I thought she was wrong, I felt unappreciated, and so on and so on. So back to the drawing board, I rewrote the entire book. And the clue, I think, was that ER thing. What was I afraid of? And I think what I was afraid of was St. Eleanor, essentially. This very idealized version of Eleanor Roosevelt that I hear over and over and over again from everybody. I mean, I'm sure the people who have met her, or their mother or father met her, they adore her, they know something wonderful that she did, you know, and all of that was getting in the way of my being able to treat this as a relationship between two women who are essentially equal partners in a relationship. So, when I started I called her Eleanor. So it was Eleanor and Lorena. It took me a while to get there because nobody in life, when she was alive, called her Eleanor. They called her Mrs. R, or they called her Mrs. Roosevelt, but they didn't call her Eleanor ever. And Franklin didn't call her Eleanor either. He called her Mrs. or Babs, but nobody called her Eleanor. So anyway, but I decided I had to call her Eleanor. And I rewrote the whole book. The first chapter, I sent to Jill. She was over the moon. She thought it was great. But then she wasn't entirely pleased with the ones that followed. And she kept reminding me how good the proposal was, which is really rankled. So months and months of rewriting followed. I was determined to finish before our spring vacation in Spain in the spring of 2014, but I wasn't finished. And my husband, who's here tonight, Danny, my other most important reader, was still reading it and suggesting ways to make it better, which was also annoying me a lot. Meanwhile, and this has happened to me a lot, and if there are other writers in the room that probably are familiar with this, the book was orphaned. Mm-hmm. The editor who bought the book left. Mm-hmm. And as I say, it's happened to me several times, and when that happens, then the editor-in-chief always says, oh, don't worry, there's a brilliant young editor who's going to take over, you know. But they're usually not so brilliant. So while we were in Spain, I really became convinced that the book was in big trouble, wasn't going to get published. Finally, I made a desperate call to my agent, who put me in touch with the Penguin's editor-in-chief. And she called me at midnight, Spanish time. She forgot about the time difference. And I was in tears. I said, what's happening with the book? And she was sort of taken aback. And she didn't know why I was so emotional. She said, well, there's no reason to be concerned. We're planning to publish it in September of 2016 and take advantage of the Hillary Clinton run for president. And she said, we have a wonderful, brilliant, new, young editor and who's going to be taking over. And but actually, as it turned out, that brilliant new young editor turned out to be a brilliant new young editor who made a lot more changes and revisions but really improved the book. So that was the happy ending for my book.
And, you know, I'm going to get some water. So, the first few times I gave this talk, I would end with that, and I'd say it was a happy ending for the book. But those, when I told the story, I thought, like a lot of us, that Hillary Clinton was about to become first woman president. But because of what's happened, the happy ending of my book story clashes with the bigger story of what's happening to our country. And I'm drawn now to different parts of the book than I was before the election. So in the past, I chose to read passages about Eleanor and Hicks' road trips, those rare occasions when they felt free of care. These were wonderful stories, happy stories. But I've chosen to read a different kind of passage tonight, one that describes their bond at a desperate moment in our history. So the background I'm going to read, this is the beginning of this story. In 1932, Lorene Hickok was a very, very successful Associated Press reporter, one of the very few women who was at the top level and who was writing national stories. And she was assigned to cover Eleanor Roosevelt. And both Eleanor and Hick were wary about this. Eleanor had been raised to feel that you shouldn't ever talk to reporters about anything, and that a woman's name should only appear in the newspaper at her debut and at her marriage. So she was reluctant to talk to reporters at all. And Lorena was reluctant because she didn't want to get stuck back on the women's page. She had climbed up from the women's page when she worked at the Milwaukee Sentinel and the Minneapolis Tribune, and she didn't want to go back there. But after spending a little time with Eleanor, she realized that this was no ordinary first lady. And as she wired her editor, she said, the dame has great character, and she's a person. And her boss wired back, she's all yours, Hickok. Have fun. So after Hickok really attached herself to Eleanor day and night, and they traveled on the train together, and Eleanor was traveling all over campaigning. And Hick detected that Eleanor was very unhappy. And she was one of the few to kind of pick up on this. And she realized, Hick began to find out, because Eleanor began to confide in her, that she was unhappy because she really did not want to be a first lady. She didn't want to go back to Washington, and she didn't want to become Mrs. R, be Mrs. R, she called it, being Mrs. R, and she really didn't want to do that. She was teaching, she was writing, she was giving speeches, she was involved in this girls' school. She had this at Valkill. Some of you may know Valkill. She and her two women partners, this lesbian couple that she was close to, the three of them had founded this little craft furniture factory together. So she had many projects and many things in her life that she really loved. And she and Franklin, starting in 1918, had pretty much decided to stay married but to live separately. That was the year, 1918, that Eleanor discovered that Franklin was having an affair with her social secretary, a woman named Lucy Mercer, and was deeply, deeply hurt by that. They talked about divorce even, but divorce would have been political suicide. So Eleanor agreed to go along and stay married. But at that point, their lives really began to be very much separate. So all of that had happened in Washington. So that was another reason that she was really feeling that she didn't want to go back there. So all of this, Hick eventually learned about Eleanor. Meanwhile, Eleanor, who always had a tremendous empathy for people who struggled, began to learn about Lorena Hickok. And Lorena Hickok's story was remarkable. She was born in Wisconsin, but to a father who somehow couldn't get along anywhere, so they moved from town to town along the railway, going continually west. And he was abusive. He beat her with barrel staves.
And she left home finally when her mother died at 13. She left home. At that point, she stopped going to school. She worked as a maid, even if not even a maid, a girl in other people's houses, just to survive. And finally was rescued by a Chicago aunt and went back to high school, got a high school degree, but never really made it in college. She tried a little bit, but she was this kind of stocky, forceful, very emotional kind of woman. And she just didn't fit in college life, and she didn't fit in sororities, which hurt her deeply. So all of that didn't work for her. But what did work for her was being a journalist. And she got started in Milwaukee, then on to Minneapolis, which became her home. And in Minneapolis, she fell in love and lived for most of that time with another woman. And then finally wound up at the AP. So Eleanor learned all of this about this difficult childhood and the struggles that Hick had had. And meanwhile, she confided in Hick about her own childhood. And of course, you know, it's tremendously, the contrasts are stunning between this childhood of Lorena Hickok and the very, very privileged childhood that Eleanor had. But one of the sort of touching things about the story is that they both had very unhappy childhoods. Eleanor, some of you probably know, was informed by her mother early on that she would never be a belle, she would never make it in society because she was so plain. Her mother died when she was 8. Her father, whom she adored, was an alcoholic and died when she was 10. So she was raised in this great big mansion on the river in Hyde Park by a Victorian grandmother who was pretty cold and distant and surrounded by servants and by a governess, a French governess she hated. So she had this, until she went away to school, which really saved her, a wonderful girls' school in England, she had this very lonely life. So the two of them coming from different places, but with both of these sad, difficult childhoods, really bonded more and more. And by the time FDR was elected, they were falling in love. And at this time, this was the last time this happened, but there was a very long interregnum between the election and the inauguration. The election was November, and the inauguration was in March. So during this period, their relationship, FDR went off on a yacht with one of his rich friends. This was typically never vacation together, but Eleanor and Hick spent that time together, and that was a time when things really deepened. So by the time the Roosevelts moved the entourage down to Washington from New York, Eleanor and Hick were very much in love. So, and that's what I'm going to, that's the passage I'm going to read you. For the most part, FDR felt the same way about Hick that he did about Eleanor's other women friends. As long as the press and public didn't notice anything irregular, and it is remarkable that they almost never did, he was happy to have Eleanor go about her own separate life, just as he went about his. He also appreciated Hick's coverage, which depicted his wife as charmingly, rather than shockingly, unconventional. In December 1932, when she took the 3:18 a.m. train from Albany to New York City to greet her son Elliot's new baby, Mrs. Roosevelt had to borrow pocket money from the Secret Service man. In January, when she traveled to Washington to visit Mrs. Hoover, she turned down a limousine in order to walk over from the Mayflower Hotel to the White House. In February, Mrs. Roosevelt chose her wardrobe for the inauguration in one afternoon. Everything in blue for mixing and matching, and removable sleeves to allow one dress to be used on more than one occasion. Someone decided to call the shade she chose Eleanor Blue, in a nod to the tradition of first ladies as fashion trendsetters. FDR found nothing to object to in any of this coverage. But on February 13th, a story appeared that enraged him. Wife of next president to drive alone to Capitol, read the headline. Accompanied by her two dogs, Mrs. Franklin Roosevelt plans on March 3rd to drive her own car, a roadster,
to Washington, where the next day she will begin her career in the White House. Mrs. Roosevelt explained that someone would have to take the dogs, a Scottish terrier named Maggie and a police dog named Major. She liked to drive, and it gave her a chance to get away. These first few weeks in Washington are going to be strenuous, she pointed out. What she didn't say in the article, authored, of course, by Hick, was that Hick was going to be at her side. FDR strenuously objected. It was a matter of appearances. He wanted the entire family to travel together to Washington on the train. Eleanor acceded to his wishes. In typical Roosevelt style, the train party numbered in the dozens. The whole family, of course, including Mother Sarah, as well as FDR's cabinet designates, political advisors, and close friends. Eleanor also brought her close friends, including Hick and the dogs. But as soon as the Roosevelt party arrived at Union Station, Eleanor returned to her previous plan to be alone with Hick as she faced the ordeal of her return. Before they separated at the train station in Washington, Eleanor made sure Hick would come to the side entrance of the Mayflower Hotel early the next morning. She wanted to take her along on a pilgrimage to something that used to mean a very great deal to me when we were in Washington before. As soon as Hick's cab pulled up the next morning, Eleanor slipped quickly out the door of the Mayflower and told the driver to go to Rock Creek Cemetery, directing him when they arrived through a maze of narrow roads to the semicircle of small shrubs surrounding a hexagonal plot. She led the way to a stone bench facing a towering bronze figure so heavily shrouded that its face was almost hidden in darkness. After a long silence, Eleanor said, "In the old days when we lived here, I was much younger and not so very wise. Sometimes I'd be very unhappy and sorry for myself. When I was feeling that way, if I could manage it, I'd come out here alone and sit and look at that woman. And I've always come away somehow feeling better and stronger. I've been here many, many times." The spectral figure was created as a memorial to Henry Adams' wife, Clover, who committed suicide in a particularly terrible way by ingesting the chemicals she otherwise used in her work as a photographer. The sculpture, by Augustus Saint-Gaudens, is called The Mystery of the Hereafter and the Peace of God that Passeth Understanding, but it is more often referred to as grief. Eleanor had visited the statue alone in the past, obeying her grandmother's dictum that strong emotions should only be expressed in private. Bringing Hick along to see the statue was an act of great trust and affection. Later that day, back at her hotel, Hick got another call from Eleanor. Franklin was tied up, she told Hick, working with James on the final draft of his acceptance speech. The other children are all out, and I'm alone. Would you mind coming over and dining with me? At the Mayflower, Hick made her way through a lobby swarming with reporters eager for small bits of information. But she was no longer part of the melee. The Secret Service men were expecting her and showed her to a special elevator that whisked her up to the presidential suite. Neither Eleanor nor Hick had much appetite for dinner that night, knowing as they did that the fate of the nation depended on Franklin Roosevelt, who was working on his speech in the sitting room next door. And I should have said, I think you all know this, that the crisis was escalating every day, and banks were closing in waves. There was no gasoline. Cars were stalled in the middle of streets. There was a threat of even a violence in some cities. So things were getting bad and worse. So late in the evening, FDR sent the final draft of his speech next door to his wife. Eleanor read it aloud to Hick. Eleanor thought it a good speech, a courageous speech. As Hick listened to the now famous words, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," it occurred to her that she was right in the middle of what, that night, was the biggest story in the world. She could have slipped out to the telephone and given the AP the essence of it, with a few choice quotations. If she had, it would have been the biggest scoop of her career. But she didn't slip out. Instead, she slipped off her dress and shoes and put on the dressing gown Eleanor handed her. By the time Eleanor returned from saying goodnight to her husband, Hick was asleep in the bedroom of her friend, who had become more important to her than any scoop. Years later, Hick would claim that she ceased to be a reporter on Inauguration Eve, when she heard FDR's entire speech and didn't do a thing about it. But in fact, her reporter role had begun to erode months before, fading as her affection for Eleanor Roosevelt grew. She continued to work for AP for another 3.5 months. Increasingly, however, her name appeared in the body of the stories rather than in the byline. She was Miss Lorena Hickok of New York, accompanying Eleanor Roosevelt as a friend or a companion. In June, she resigned from the AP. On July 26th, she was identified in one story as Miss Lorena Hickok, a former New York newspaper woman. It had taken Hick 17 years to move from the society pages of the Milwaukee Sentinel to a top spot in the New York offices of the Associated Press, where she had achieved standing, this is a quote, that no other woman had matched. It was slowly dawning on her, and on Eleanor too, that all of that was now in jeopardy. Late Monday night, after Hick had left for New York following the inauguration, Eleanor sat down to write her a letter. "Hick, my dearest," it began, "I cannot go to bed tonight without a word to you. You have grown so much to be a part of my life that it is empty without you, even though I'm busy every minute." The letter ended, "Oh, darling, I hope on the whole you will be happier for my friendship. I felt I had brought you so much discomfort and hardship today, and almost more heartache than you could bear, and I don't want to make you unhappy. All my love, and I shall be saying to you over thought waves in a few minutes, good night, my dear one. Angels guard thee. God protect me. My love enfold thee all the night through." The letter, the first of thousands that Eleanor and Hick would exchange over a lifetime, was dated March 5th, 1933. 2 days later, Hick would turn 40. Her old life as a newspaper reporter was over. As of that moment, she had no idea how she would live her new one, but she knew she wanted to live it with Eleanor Roosevelt. I'll stop there. So I'll be happy to hear your comments or questions. Yes?
Well, say that your description of writing the story is as compelling as the story itself. It really was. And the one thing you said, I had never thought of before as a writer myself, which is when you're stuck, you have to ask yourself, what are you afraid of? You mentioned that. It just like opened up a whole new way of trying to understand the story.
My mood about what I wanted to read. And this, I felt I chose somewhat of a darker, more somber part of the story. And also, I've been thinking a lot about how momentous this move to the White House was and how all these people understood it as a momentous and how hollowed out it seems this time around. You know, and so I guess it was the contrast, the enormity of the burden that FDR felt and that they all felt. It seems to be not felt in the same way now. So, to say the least, I guess that was it. It wasn't more specific than that. Yes.
I wonder why does anybody know? Did you
What happened was that Maria knew more and more secrets about the Roosevelt family as time went on, and there were a lot of secrets, not only FDR's paralysis, which was kept from the general public, but also the fact that her daughter was in the middle of a messy divorce, and her sons had various kinds of problems. Her brother was drinking himself to death. So all of this, and Ellen knew it all. There was one particular instance. Prohibition was the big issue in that election, and FDR was campaigned it to end prohibition. And Eleanor, who hated alcohol and hated even the smell of it because of the way that devastated her family, was sort of trying to argue that people needed to learn self-control. Like, the laws couldn't teach people to have self-control about drinking. But she said it sort of cavalierly. She said, nowadays, a girl needs to know how to hold her gin. Well, this was picked up by the press and used as an illustration of the fact that Eleanor was probably maybe herself a drinker or somebody who didn't care about, you know, holding her gin. It's completely distorted. And so Hick's bosses wanted her to do this story, and she refused. And her bosses actually fined her over that. Mm-hmm. That was just a small example of the kind of stories that she wasn't willing to write, increasingly because of her loyalty. And it got just harder and harder to not reveal secrets. So
I have to switch to something that has nothing to do with politics.
Roosevelts were the big story, and she was right in the middle of it. It would have been very, very hard for her to do that. I do think later, if she stayed healthy, she had diabetes, she smoked too much, she kept overweight, all kinds of things. I think later that she could have gone to Europe and covered the war. And I think she would have been really great at that. She was somebody who always found the personal story within the big story. She was one of those kind of people. When reading the obituary of Jimmy Breslin recently, I was struck by how much Maureen Hickok was a Breslin kind of character. He said at one point, when there's a big story, I always go to the locker room. And that's what she did. She went to the locker room. She found individuals to tell their stories, and she was wonderful at that. I think it would have been difficult for her at that moment. I think she could maybe gone back later, as I say, but at that point, I think it would have been really complicated for her to continue. Yes, and it was a terrible thing. It's a tragic moment in her life because she never fully recovered. Although what did happen, and this, I didn't even talk about this, but thanks to Eleanor, she got signed by Harry Hopkins to go around the country and report on the Great Depression and on the situation of poor people around the country. And she wrote marvelous reports. Some people say that her reports are the best single record of the Depression, what happened in the Depression, so that it's not like she didn't keep writing and that she didn't have a second career and keep on with her writing career, but in a different way. Yes?
Did you have unfettered access to the letters between
yes.
him? And I know that, you know, with same-sex couples, it's not what you do, it's how you feel about each other. Do you fall in love with? But were there any indications of a physical relationship between the two of them?
There are in the letters.
Yeah.
When they're away from each other.
I read your book, but I didn't, you know, pick that up.
Did you read the book?
I did.
Hot modern sex at all, you know. But there's enough there to indicate that when they were together, they liked holding each other, kissing each other, there was affection that way, you know. And I think it was physical to some extent. And the other thing you have to know is that Eleanor was a very physically inhibited person. Her children all said this about her, that she was very loving, very concerned, but she never touched or hugged them at all. So I think she might have been freer with Marina than she actually was in her relationships with the men she had crushes on. But I don't think that the physical part of it was, wild. I think it was there. And I just want to say one other thing about that, which
I mentioned briefly about Willa Cather, and that is that all of Eleanor's circle of friends, almost all of them, her close friends, were lesbians, and they were all in life partnerships. So this was a milieu in which this was happening, and it was okay. I mean, it was hiding in plain sight. Nobody used the word lesbian, you know, but for instance, you know, Nan and Marianne, with whom she had Val Kill, were life partners, as were her big political allies and influences. So this was there around her. So it doesn't seem so extraordinary that she would fall into this, particularly at a time when she was very vulnerable. And Hick met a lot of her needs in terms of not just affection, but also helping her to negotiate a new kind of role for a first lady. And Hick was very important in that. Yes.
Would it be possible for you to do an edited volume of those discussions? Mm-hmm.
There is one book. It's called One Third of a Nation, and it does include quite a few of those dispatches, but there are a bunch more that haven't been published, and I have thought about doing that. Hick also wrote an autobiography that's quite wonderful, not a whole one, but pieces, and she couldn't get that published, I think, because she had the same agent as Eleanor Roosevelt, and Roosevelt's writing, although it was rather mediocre really, was enormously popular, and she sold, you know, hundreds of thousands. So, you know, that was the wrong agent for Hick, because Hick's writing is much more tempestuous and full of her real life and of her falling in love with her schoolmates, and all kinds of things that would, at that time, have been helpful in terms of Eleanor's book sales. So I think that, you know, she didn't have much of a chance of getting that published then, and I think it could be published now, and it's quite wonderful. It's very vivid about this very difficult childhood that she had. So, good question. You had more.
Yeah, well, what surprised you most out of this whole work on this book about them? And did you have any feedback from them as well?
I talked to the oldest granddaughters at who knew Hick. The only feedback, and some others who knew of her. I sent it to Sisti, the oldest granddaughter, Eleanor, called Sisti in the family. And she wrote me back right away, this is a very smart move, saying, thank you so much for sending me the book. I'm not sure I'll agree with everything in it, but I know it will be well written. She'd known my previous work. And I haven't heard from her since, and I haven't pursued her. I know that the family, when this first came out, when Blanche Weisenkook, who is the biographer of Eleanor Roosevelt, and has just published her third volume, was the one who outed the relationship in volume one, and the family apparently was very unhappy about that, but that's been years ago, so it's been out there for a long time. So I didn't get any negative feedback, but. Yeah.
How she felt about it, or how Franklin felt about it?
Well, no, how Franklin thought about it, and also how she thought about it. Because I'm wondering if she really thought that there was this, or she perceived that there was an attraction or a sexual component, or did she see it essentially as a friendship? And
I think she thought as a love relationship. This was only for about 4 or 5 years, and then it changed. And Hick wanted it to be much, much more. And she would have liked to go off with Eleanor and live together forever. But Eleanor, increasingly, partly because of Hick's help, became this enormously beloved person with all kinds of people wanting a piece of her. Plus, Eleanor, I don't think,
could have been comfortable with a one-to-one relationship. The few times she went out to Hicks Cottage and they had a weekend together, by the end of the weekend she was dying because she couldn't get to a phone and she couldn't get to her secretary. And she could, you know, she wanted and needed a lot of people around her, and an intense one-to-one relationship just wasn't going to work. And Hick was very jealous and tempestuous, and there was a point at which it looked like, in fact, she might lose Eleanor altogether if she didn't calm down and get control of her jealousy. And she, to her credit, she went off and did her job for several months, absented herself from Washington, and kind of got some perspective and was able to cool the relationship some. So then they remained friends for the rest of their lives and wrote to each other all that time. There's something you asked, though, that I didn't
surprise.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, one thing that surprised me was that Maria Hancock lived in the White House for the entire Roosevelt term of 13 years. She had her own room at the White House. And she was there not all the time because she was out in the field doing things and working for the Democratic Party while you're doing stuff in New York. But she had her room. And she always said that she at first claimed that it was because she didn't have a lot of money, and Eleanor was always a sucker for that, you know, and so she said, you know, you have to stay here. But she admitted that it wasn't only that, it was that she knew this was one way that she would get to see Eleanor more than other people did. And Eleanor would come in often from her office and sit on the end of the bed, and they would talk late at night. So that was great for me, because Hank was in the White House a lot, even when Eleanor wasn't there, because Eleanor traveled a lot. So Hick would be there, and things would happen in the White House, and Hick wrote about them. So I was able to use those things in my book as a way of moving the story. I knew that one of the challenges was not just the story of Eleanor and Hick, but the story of all the events that were happening around them, these enormous, momentous events, you know, the Depression and then World War II. So through Hick's lens, sometimes, there was one instance where there was this conference in the Atlantic, and the admirals came back, and Hick was in her bathing suit coming down from the pool and saw the whole thing. You know, so I had that scene, which is pretty great. So that was a big surprise to me. And the Roosevelt White House was a big surprise to me. The thing, the house was always full of people. They were always inviting people. They had dinner for 30, 40 people regularly, several nights a week. You know, and people stayed overnight. All kinds of people stayed overnight. Or they worked there. You know, Martha Gellhorn, at one point, Eleanor invited her to come and write at the White House. So it was just this kind of constant open house, a very different atmosphere than usual, and apparently kind of a mess a lot of the time. Franklin's overworld was apparently very messy. So it was comfortable. Someone said, well, the Roosevelts are used to living in big, grand houses. You know, that's nothing new to them. It's not a big deal. And after all, Eleanor's uncle Teddy had already lived there. So they had a very different attitude about the whole thing. So that was a surprise. I was just on a panel with Blanche Weeson Cook, who said that Eleanor was just a born romantic. She was always falling in love. But you know, it's not quite that simple. She was always falling in love with men who were unavailable. I even think Franklin wasn't so available, you know, because of his mother Sarah, who really ruled the roost. So that was a triangle, you know. And then she was in other relationships with Nan and Marion about Val Kill. You know, they were a couple. She was the third person. And then she fell in love with this Joe Lash. She was this young radical. But he was in the middle of courting another woman, and Eleanor kind of was a go-between. She was in love with him, but she was also somehow involved in his falling in love with someone else. And then late in life, she really fell in love with a man named David Gurevich, who was a Russian-born Swiss-Jewish doctor, whom a younger man, very charming, cosmopolitan, and because he was fluent in Russian, he was great to travel with. They went to Russian together, and he translated for her when she met Khrushchev, and so on. And each of these choices really helped her along at some point in her life, but each of these choices, except for Hick, were choices in which she was
number three. He married this young woman, and at the end of their lives, they bought a house together. And Eleanor lived on one floor, and David and his wife lived on the other floor. So this was a life pattern that's quite fascinating. Maybe somebody can write more about that. Yes?
She seemed to be very close to Adlai Stevenson. Mm-hmm. Is there any mention of that in your book?
Yes, yes. She was a big supporter of Adlai. Of course, when Jack Kennedy came along, she wasn't sure that she could even support him. You know, she wanted to support Adlai for yet another time around. But then in the end, he came and met with her. And he was very taken with her, and she was pretty impressed with him. And that inaugural, Jack Kennedy's inaugural, was one of the last public things that she attended before she died. But yes, Adlai was really important to her.
Maybe one more question?
Pardon me?
And maybe one more question?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, I could go on forever, obviously. Yes.
Over here.
Okay, I'm sorry.
In reading the correspondence, which must have been a real privilege, did you come to a conclusion why Eleanor never seemed to really believe people admired and loved her? Because, I mean, all the way back to Alan Wood, I mean, there were people who loved her.
Oh, yeah.
Dedicatedly.
Yes,
but she could never really...
Yeah.
Internal.
I mean, I think it was one of the things about Hick that really was important. Hick saw her as a queen, you know, and perfect and beautiful in every way. She described her in a long gown, like how beautiful she was. And that meant a lot, because Eleanor always felt, and she even said this, that she was plain, you know, and that she didn't measure up, and that was the message she got from her mother. And, you know, in Alice Wood, yes, she was adored, and of course, you know, Mademoiselle Sylvester, the headmistress, adored her and traveled with her. And I think that was one time, you know, she made her go to a tailor in Paris and get a red, beautiful red dress for herself. You know, and it was one of the few times where I think she did feel good, pretty good about herself. But it was never, it never took entirely. I don't know the answer to the question. I mean, it's a mystery, you know, this woman who was so amazing and yet, you know, had this self-esteem issue always, you know. So, okay, so, yes.
Could you talk a little bit about how Hick's journalist colleagues and supervisors reacted to the couple and to Hick's retreat from journalism?
Hick encouraged Eleanor to have these all-women press conferences. And the result of that was that some of the news organizations had to hire women. So the result of that was, I mean, the other women journalists liked Hick anyway, but they liked her even more after that. You know, she pretty much endeared herself to the women press corps. I think they all knew about the relationship. I'm sure there were some lesbians among the women's press corps. And certainly they weren't going to, you know, out her in any way. That just wasn't, and I don't quite understand this, because I don't understand why some of the really nasty journalists didn't go after this relationship, but they did. I don't know, it was sort of so uncomfortable for everyone. First, it was a crime and a shame, was, you know, to be a lesbian, and all that was so much, so buried, that it didn't even create scandal, which is mystifying.
Probably a good place to stop. Okay.